Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million. You didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatec.
No, you're working at Inatec because that question is bullshit to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up if they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million...
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world, and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Oh, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke. Don't do
if I had a
Welcome up back, Saxon Jackson. I'm Tom Out. Andrew on the board. SP Futures up 3. NASDAQ Futures down 34. This is after a pretty nasty day yesterday in the NASDAQ, at least. NASDAQ was down 355 yesterday. It's 1.3%. S&P was down 53.7. Not as bad, but it was not good. This morning, we got the Nikkei's down $2,100. That's I guess it's 2,100 yen, but it's... That's 3%. That's not a good deal. We actually, Hang Seng is up a little bit. So, anyway, do we have Professor Kevin?
Yeah, good morning.
How are you?
Well, I'm doing all right. I'm sitting outside. It's a lovely morning. So, what could be wrong with the world?
Well, that's it is lovely. Here, I don't know if you can sit outside. The mosquitoes are like a horde after all this rain. They'll pick you up and drop you.
What does it really do, because there's zero wind and the water is glass, is I should probably put you guys on the phone while I drag the kayak out to the water and paddle around and talk to you while I'm paddling around.
No, because what happens if we heard a big splash? How am I going to come pull you out?
You're not, but I will have a life preserver on. I always wear a life preserver. Yeah,
that's a good thing.
It's a good thing when I'm out there alone, and right now there isn't another soul. There's not anybody out fishing or anything. I would be totally on my own. So and think about this, because you know, if you're talking about a kayak, old man out there that, you know, somehow you get capsized and I have to climb back in. I don't think so.
Well, can you just grab onto the side of it? Is it calm?
Or just kind of paddleboard.
Yeah, I mean, you grab on the side, you use one hand, and finally make it over to shore if it's that calm.
Yep. Yeah, and I do the same thing with the oar. I see people out there all the time paddling. Think how screwed you would be if you dropped the oar. So I actually have a little tether line on there so that if anything were to happen with that, I could just grab it. Because what am I going to do, hand paddle over to something that's drifting away from me? I don't think so.
Well, it doesn't matter which side you get to, as long as you get to a side.
Yeah. No, but what I'm saying is if I'm in the boat but don't have the oar, try that little chase.
Well, I remember when I was thinking about learning how to sail, and I, of course, Dr. J and I rented this sailboat for this summer. Of course, he knew something. I didn't know anything, which was really stupid.
Sounds like a boondoggle all the way, right?
Oh, God. It was absolutely ridiculous, the fact that I actually went out on the damn thing with people that didn't, you know. But there was the best line. He's out on this thing. It's got this little outboard motor, right? So all of a sudden they see this real nasty storm kind of coming. So, you know, it turns the motor on. The thing goes like 2 miles an hour. So it's heading in, and somebody goes, "John, how bad is it?" And he goes, "Well, let's put it this way. If we had life preserves, now would be the time to put them on." People would, the stupid stuff people did, and somehow survived. I don't know. I guess we were just lucky or something. I don't know. But
we were young, stupid, and indestructible.
Yeah. But you know, somewhat resourceful too, I think, maybe. But you like to think that anyway. But
no, there are plenty of times I think back and go, there, but by the grace of God, you know.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
There are so many times I say, "Do you know how dangerous that was?"
Yeah. Or, you know, you go. The fact that people used to go skiing in the woods without cell phones, and you know, you never had a cell phone. We drove from in a total blizzard, and I don't know how many below zero it was. We drove from West Yellowstone to Grand Targhee Resort in an old Jeep, and at one point, you know, we were driving First of all, I didn't realize how cold it was when you're on a snowmobile in Yellowstone, because, you know, you got the snowmobile outfit on and a helmet. You know, it could be 10 below, which I guess it was. So we get in this Jeep and we're driving, and you got to go west on 20 before you get on this county road to get down to what the hell's the name of it? Town, but then you go right up into Grand Targhee. And we turned on this road. Well, the wind was so strong it was drifting halfway across the road. And we got no cell phone, we got nothing. So the guy in the right seat had to open the window, let me know how close I was to the drift. So I'm hugging the left lane, because that was the only spot where there was any pavement. And all of a sudden, we on this fence post, we see this big old owl looking at us like, look at these idiots. But somehow we didn't see another car for 25 miles. And if we would have, we'd have been in the same spot as he was. But, yeah, I guess we'd have seen the headlights coming. But I'm sitting there going, what possessed us to do that? You know, there was no payphones, no gas stations. You know, of course, at least if you're going skiing, you got enough clothes. You know, so it's not like you're gonna die of cold because, you know, you got all of your duds. But still, you sit there and go, do we really have to do that at night?
But and those duds are only good for so long. I mean, there is, you know, it's not that, you know, they don't lock out the cold completely.
No,
they fend it off, and there's a cumulative effect of being out in there.
Oh yeah, and you know, the Jeep is something you wouldn't even drive today, little across country. Hey, I sent you that thing. I want to talk a little bit about some sports here because of some more levity.
Yeah, and you know, yesterday was a 8 o'clock a.m. to 9 o'clock p.m. day for me, so I haven't read anything. So you're gonna have to summarize.
Well, I sent you like a YouTube video, and there's a guy I've listened to a couple of his things, and you know, everybody's got a little bit of an agenda, but you'll learn something from everything. And he was doing the trying to draw comparisons between the Fed's moves and the stock market moves and the economy in the late 20s versus today. And the parallels, and there's parallels, but there's also stuff that's different, I think. And so it's not as, but the thing that struck me, and I never, you know, Kevin, even if it's people you don't agree with, all of a sudden something lands on you and you go, if they're seeing that, they're seeing it for a reason, what are they seeing that I'm not seeing? And I at least try and understand where they're coming from, even if I don't agree necessarily with their, you know, path out of the problem type of thing. I mean, even though, you know, I may not like some of the stuff the current administration does, I certainly see what they saw to see where it would be popular, and it is a problem. So even if I don't agree with the method necessarily, it doesn't mean I'm not aware that they saw something that maybe I didn't. You know, so I try and be that way anyway, because I don't do it all the time. But anyway, he was talking about, he went from 1926, 27, 28, 29, and it was the Fed gets themselves into a bind, because all of a sudden the markets are going, you know, basically to the moon, and it was all, you know, with speculation. The prices were ridiculously high, and at the time the margin, you could buy something with 10 cents on the buck, where now it's 50%. Except that's not really true either, because if you go to the futures side, I mean, like, you know, we do both here at PTI. I mean, if you trade the SPY all day long, which is the S&P 500 ETF, it's margin just like a stock. Okay, now, so if you want to buy spiders or 767, so if you lighten up get the butterflies out of your wallet and you call me up, my brother, and say, I want to buy 1,000 spiders, well, that's 767 grand. That's a chunk. You really don't have to send us a check only for half of that, so say 386 or something, which, you know, you're still, it's 50% margin. It goes down a little bit. It slides down to 30%. It still could be a problem, okay? But now on the futures side, if you say, well, screw that, I don't want to put up that kind of money, you could buy the S&P futures over at the CME. Well, now your margin on that used to be like 5%. I think it's up to something. We had another guy here who does all our future stuff and keeps track of that. But the margin is appreciably less than if you buy it on the security side. Now, it's still not, you know, 10%, although way back in the day, I think it was. But now you have to mark yourself to market there every day, which means if you max out on the margin, I'll use an easier example. Say you buy a soybean contract. It's 5,000 bushels. The margin on that used to be, say, $500. it's probably a little more now, but say it's $500. Don't quote me on the margin things. I mean, of course, I could find out if you want to do a trade here. But if it goes down and you lose $200 that day, you got to come up with the $200. Okay, so it's there's no slide. So does it say that just because the securities margin is 50%, it's way, way less than 29? It's not really true. Because we actually have a few clients on the IB side that trade the futures because the margin's less. Now, they've got enough money, and we make sure they don't go too crazy. But still, does it make me more nervous than if they did it on the security side? Yes, it does. You know, and we pay much closer attention to those people than we do the other people. Because that's what we do. And so with this guy, but the point he was making, Kevin, is once you get to this spot, and he was saying once you get to 1928 or so, and it was getting so ridiculous that even the people were aware that they were way out on their skis, and so was the Fed at some point, but they elected to not do anything. And he said the meeting minutes from 1929 read almost verbatim as today. They know there's a problem. They know there's rampant speculation. Well, it's not as rampant as it was then. Yet they decide like to do nothing. But the point is that is totally new to me. As he said, once you cross the line, whatever the line is, and you get over the line, even the routine intelligent adjustment becomes the catalyst for the crash. So in other words, if you say there's way too much speculation, we're going to raise the margin requirements. By the way, the Fed didn't send them back, the individual brokerage firms did, which is a problem. If we're going to make everybody jump to 20% because this is getting rampant, just that sober, intelligent move could actually cause the crash then, even though that's the right thing to do. So the point was, if and by the way, the margin loans are down last month. So they were up so much in 3 months. I've been talking about they were down last month because the market's back up. But if it got to that, and I never thought of it that way, Kevin. And I've said if the Fed really wants to, to fight inflation, which I don't think this guy does, because I don't think his boss wants him to. I mean, you would keep your money supply growth here. You'd stop growing the money supply. You'd probably raise the initial margin, certainly on the futures a little bit, which the SEC or the Fed, I don't think, controls. But
would you make a significant change, or would you glide back?
No, even if it 50, I'm talking about if you went from 50 to 55 percent, something like that. Or if you okay. and go.
I mean, because you can say here's where it really needs to be.
Yeah.
But you can say let's step into that so that we don't to minimize the shock, or at least to attempt to minimize the shock.
But there's a lot of people that don't have those margin requirements. You can have portfolio margin at RIB place. You can have firm margin if you're a member of an exchange. So there's ways like to get around it where people have. But his point is that even if you were to say, okay, we're going to, I'm appalled by the fact that there's no bank reserve requirement. Okay, I've been appalled, everybody knows, for a while. I think Carl's probably with me on that. But this guy's point is, even if you realize these are three sober, simple things to do to at least, give the message that, you're going to try and cut this back a little bit. Because if you get so far out there, that if you're too late with even the sober little adjustment, you cause the crash that was going to happen anyway, but that's the day that it happens. Because if your margin is that far out there and all of a sudden you tell people, well, instead of sending me $1,000 today, you got to send me $1,500, all of a sudden everybody will start to sell and you're screwed. And I never thought of that. I don't know why I didn't, but what do you think? You can psychoanalyze me here.
Think of the analogy. Let's just say you have a violent intruder in your house, or a potentially violent intruder in your house. Because that's what we're looking at, right? Economically, the deficit that we run, the amount of spending we have, the amount of money that we put into the system, all of that. Let's call that our violent intruder. Well, you can hide, which we've been trying to do.
Yep.
Or you can fight. And sooner or later, you're right. Fight becomes the thing that you have to do. You have no other choice. But when you get yourself backed into a corner, and you have no other way out but to fight, well, that is correctly the rational thing to do. It's also the thing that might get you killed.
Yeah, that's exactly kind of his point. And you know what, Kevin? I've been doing this a long time, and everybody knows I think about this economics because I loved it. I never... So their point is, if you did what I want to do, like, even if it's a little bit, the fact that it's all of a sudden, people will go, uh-oh, kind of thing. And that, I guess you could take heart in the fact that it would have happened anyway. But his point is, it's going to happen, but the further you wait, the worse it gets, which is what Carl's been talking about.
You know? And that's kind of true of any any problem that you have, or virtually any problem. Every once in a while, you can ignore something and it goes away, but that's not frequent. And so that's true in life as well. But let's think about what are the best things that we could do as a cure. Well, there's the things that you mentioned that are macroeconomic, but if we were to address the big gorilla in the elephant in the room, I guess it would be healthcare. So what do we want to do? Well, let me see. We want to enforce antitrust law. We want to restrict patent protection, and probably that that's probably as good a start as there is, as we could have. And suddenly you are going to shock the system. There is going to be some pain because that's such a significant part of the economy, and we are about to give it a gigantic shock. Now, that's what I think there's a lot of people who know what needs to be done, but they're afraid of what needs to be done.
I don't even know how to do it, though, Kevin. How do you, when you have, 15 mergers in the last 5 years in hospitals in the Chicago area, how do you take them apart? I don't even know.
Well, you take them apart the same way that you did the Bell system once upon a time, even though it's all back together in a different way now. But if you go back to the breakup that resulted from the MCI case, that has to happen. And of course, that would be a very, very long-term process just to wind that through the courts and to succeed and to cause the breakup of some of those mergers. That would be, that would be a really big deal. But you're right, that's not going to happen next year. That's not something where you can say, well, we'll put that in the agenda for 2027, because that... it can't be done. You can put filing, filing the, getting into the filings and looking at the antitrust and the market, everything that goes into that. But there also has to be a plaintiff here, because I don't think the government is going to have standing. So someone's going to have to be the plaintiff who has standing and goes in and says, this is damaging me, and here is how is it is damaging me. Could be a state, and a state, talking about its share of Medicaid and that the current system is damaging. But one way or another, you got to find somebody who is willing to start the process, see it all the way through, who has the money to do it, and who has the backing to do it, because there's going to be a lot of backing of resistance. And, I see real problems in that, too. So when you ask how you're going to do it, oh, that's a little bit of a problem, because how did we get here? I like to say gradually and then suddenly, but this one has been, gradually for decades. I don't think there's anything sudden about it.
I also, in terms of the rigorousness of what you're trying to accomplish, that's a dumb statement, but Milton Friedman was always big on that. But he was a... before you take some of these places apart, you could say, because they're anti-competitive or not all that competitive, people are overpaid, people are just saying, you can go down that road. But I also think you'd need some sort of an idea of what, how big a place has to be before they are, what's the word for like efficient? You're big enough to be efficient. I mean, it's a, most places, I think, if you guys still teach it, it's kind of like a step function growth, because it's sort of hard to figure out, what's the optimal size drug company, I guess is my question, or what's the optimal size hospital? You sort of have to have some idea that, going in. I mean, does a small community hospital like, we used to have, do they have any chance of being competitive? I don't know. Before I started messing with the system, It's kind of something I think I should know. Of course, we have a lot of politicians that don't care about that. On both sides of the aisle, they just have an idea. And as I used to say at Pullman, whale away with a half sachet, right? I think you and I would like to figure out, because Milton Friedman said something I thought pretty intelligent. He said, if I could clone for 2 weeks and have nothing else to do, I'd really like to attack the business side of economics and find out how big the most efficient place is. And I forget what there was some merger at the time. It wasn't Upjohn and Squibb. It was somebody. Because I think that merger is going to make them less efficient. They're already probably together, individually, a pretty optimum size. So if you put them together, other than laying a bunch of people off, he said, I'm not so sure they get more efficient. I bet they get less after a certain time, after a certain size.
I saw that over the years in the banking industry where there were so many of these acquisitions and a very, very high percentage of them were diluted to earnings. They did not, they were proposed as accretive, but they were diluted partly because people really aren't very good at merging companies together. They just aren't. That process of pulling it all together, believe me, I've had to do it, five times. It is really, really hard. It's hard to do it well. And so that becomes a big issue. And I think you're right in bringing it up. Some of it is just what is the right answer. And I think that's what Friedman was after, is what's the right answer. But the other side of that is, can people execute to achieve the right answer?
Well, but I think you sort of have to have an idea where you're going, though, first. You know what I'm saying? And I don't know if anybody knows that. I mean, it's not like we have people who can't find out. I mean, if we actually had some kind of marriage between, which we sure don't have now, between academia and Congress where they could actually find some of this stuff out. I mean, we have a perfect example. I don't know if you were listening yesterday when Kenny was on. And this is what, and this has been, my bitch, maybe because Carl's always talking about it, for a long time. I mean, somehow, some way, Kenny was saying his wife wasn't feeling good, wasn't sure if she had a heart attack or not. Well, they took her to the emergency room. He took her to the emergency room. So they were only there an hour or two. They gave her the blood test, see if you get the enzymes of a heart attack, gave her EKG. And everything was fine. It was some, I don't know if he said it was indigestion, whatever it was. So off she goes. The bill's like 10 or 11 grand. Well, that bill, from any kind of cost accounting background, the incremental cost of having her walk in that door for 2 hours on a machine you already have and all this other stuff, I got to believe the incremental cost can't be $500, maybe $1,000, if somebody actually looks at her, which I doubt if they did, if all the tests came out back. How do we get that number down to $1,500 instead of 11 grand, Kevin? That needs to be our focus, because somehow we have to do it.
Let me do you one better, because I saw what the price tag was going to be for a liver biopsy, which I wound up not needing, thankfully. But a liver biopsy, all they're going to do is they're going to go in with a needle. They're going to put you under. They're going to go in with a needle, and they're going to, I don't know if it's a needle, with an instrument, and they're going to grab just a little piece of the liver tissue, pull it out, and then send it to the lab. $60,000 was the price tag on that.
Now, I'm going to say that
that's the one that we are wondering why it shouldn't be $1,500.
And well, then you have to ask yourself, and you won't know till after if you're awake, how many people were there, what level were they, what are their annual salaries, and what kind of room were you in? Were you in a massive operating room with all electronics, or were you in, if you're just in a bed somewhere, with your heart hooked up to something? I mean, if you could walk through the incremental costs, I'm going to say they weren't $2,000. If pay who's ever doing it, I guess you could say to guys, we're going to make $1 million a year. So where does that put them? $5,000 a day. Mm-hmm. Give them half a day, which is BS. All right. So give him $2,500. Give the his attending guy, who's probably a doctor, give him two, even though he's not making anywhere near that. Give the three nurses standing there one. So what are you up to? Seven? In the room, give them $3,000 for the room, you're up to 10. and I'm being amazingly generous here. Where are you getting the 70? What's the overhead rate? 700%?
Well, or you're talking about the overhead rate. So really, we're talking about, you know, what's a gross margin in healthcare? Because, you know, you get into a lot of businesses, and you know, if you could achieve a 50% gross margin, you'd be drooling. I can't believe they're looking at a 50% gross margin on theirs.
Well, first of all, it's not a gross margin because there's no profit, which is even more bizarre.
Well, yeah, but there is because there's a direct cost of delivery and a revenue for that. And so when you're talking about the direct cost of delivery, it is a gross margin, whatever you want to call it, for healthcare. And so, you know, it's got to be in the hundreds of percents.
Yeah. So where does it go? Does it go to a building that's, you know, the building is the size of a city block and the room they're doing this to you is the size of my little office here? I mean,
the whole damn thing is the size of a city. But that's a whole system and it's holistic. And, you know, I don't have a problem with that. But it is... how luxurious, because I can think of a local hospital here where up in St. Joseph, where they have good doctors. It's Corewell Health, and they have good doctors and they have good people. But you walk into that hospital, here's the really nice coffee shop and this really beautiful lobby, and I'm sitting here going, this isn't necessary, and this isn't how I remember hospitals from years ago. You know, we've made that. It's just like it's, you know, shifting the conversation a little bit. It's like what they've done with so many colleges. It's, you know, University of Missouri's famous climbing wall for the students to be able to use for they don't need that. You know, we had handball courts, we had basketball courts. That was fine, and they weren't lavish. You know, and you know, everybody's coming up with these lavish facilities, and you know, once you're in that, you know, that little room that where they put you to get ready for surgery, you don't give a poop about what's going on out in the lobby area.
Well, I mean, you look at the colleges, and sometimes you hear from other people from one of our reunions when we were staying in the dorm. Audrey, of course, comes with, and now, you know, when we were there, the cost of room and board was roughly a grand. I know that because I was an RA my senior year, and that's how I got paid. I didn't have to pay room and board. Might have been $1,100, Kevin, but it was something like that. Okay, so you got, you know, a room, you got the army cot, or you had the day bed, and you walk down the hall to go to the bathroom and shower up, and you ate, you know, chicken and mystery meat every night, but everything was fine. I mean, well, now all of a sudden, like Audrey goes...
Or you took a look at dinner and went to Burger King.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, but it was always our late Bill Moriarty was on the show a bunch and just unfortunately passed some cancer. Bill used to come down and visit, and we'd smuggle him into the rack. We'd play basketball. Bill was a good basketball player, and we'd smuggle him into dinner. Now he was in the Evan Scholar House in Milwaukee, which, you know, was essentially our old household kind of fraternity house place, but the food wasn't included. So they knew every, you know, all-you-could-eat place, every 59-cent burger in the town of Milwaukee. So I take him into the dining hall, and somebody's bitching about dinner, and he goes, God, you guys eat like this all the time. This is spectacular. So it's kind of the eye of the beholder. He's sitting there eating big chicken breasts and mashed potatoes. He goes, you guys get this every day?
Yeah, he was probably living on real chili.
Yeah, I mean, he goes, but now, like I said, I went to the reunion. Audrey's there and goes, wait a minute, you're paying 10 grand for room and board. My daughter's not sleeping on an army cot going down the hall to pee for 10 grand. So which comes first? The fact that you got to make it lavish or the fact that you're charging so much, it better be lavish? I don't know. That. I mean, I keep saying I'm kind of a cost account. I can never answer that question, Kevin. Which comes first?
I'll go with the egg.
Hey, baseball. I haven't watched that much, but I picked
very,
up...
Very, very good to me.
Yeah, well, I think... Hey, you know what we're going to have on today? After a long time, we're going to have retired Professor Eric May is coming on today to tell us about his writings on the...
Well, I wish I could hang around for it, but you're going to have to tell Eric hello for me because I'm going to have to duck out for a meeting. John's going to come on a few minutes early, too, so that he can cover.
But the baseball, you know, I'm not Mr. Stat or anything, but I think there's three or four of the best young teams I've seen in a long time, Kevin. I mean, this White Sox phenomenon, even, you know, they lost in 11. Last night was so cool. I dozed off in the middle of the game like usual, and I woke up thinking, well, it must be over, and it wasn't over. I got to watch the end because they had a rain delay. The White Sox have done a spectacular job with young players. St. Louis Cardinals the same way. The Nationals pretty much off the chart. And same thing with Detroit. That's only four I kind of know of young players coming up. And those guys are going to be, those teams are going to be good for a long time. It's really fun to watch, I think, don't you?
Well, I would say yes, they should be good for a long time. However, you may remember the prior incarnation of the White Sox.
Yeah.
With Eloy Jimenez and what was the center fielder's name?
Well, they had all these Hispanic guys, then they fired the Hispanic coach and put Chuck Tanner in there.
Well, no. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about most recently Tim Anderson.
Yeah.
Roberts
was a center fielder, right?
No. Lewis Robert.
Yeah.
Yep. Luis Robert and all of those guys. They had a whole bunch of talent, and they made the playoffs, but this was the group where they hired Tony La Russa, who's kind of screwed up everything.
That's what I meant, not Chuck Tanner. Tony La Russa,
brought him out of retirement. Well, he's only slightly less dead than Chuck Tanner.
Plus, it was a very Spanish-denominated team.
It was going to open its playoff window and its championship window for 5-6 years, and it lasted a year.
Yeah.
So I would say, you know, cautionary tale. Yeah, they're bringing up a lot of talent, but it can be a fragile mix, and it's dependent on a lot of things. Some of it is the talent and the talent remaining consistent, because there are players who come up and they have early success, but it starts to wane at the end of the season, and you know you're playing spy versus spy with the league. They're always adjusting, and you have to adjust back. So there's some that'll do that, and hopefully for those teams' sake, it'll be most will do that. And then the flip part of that, the other side of that, is that they'll avoid injuries and that they will have good leadership, because leadership can really bleep things up pretty quickly. And that was what happened with the White Sox, I think, as much as anything. They had health issues. Jimenez could never stay healthy, and he was their basically 3-4 hitter. So I would say yes, I agree. There are 3-4, maybe even 5 teams that have a lot of good young talent. But look at Seattle from last year.
Yeah.
You know, Seattle had everything going for it. They were an up and comer. They haven't been nearly that team this year.
Yeah. Well, there is some strength. I mean, you know, Kevin, we played softball together for a long time, and I coached forever. If you have people that kind of grow up together, are comfortable kind of in the position they're playing, and like the people they're playing with. It's not all about just likes and stuff. I mean, Lou Gehrig and Babe Ruth didn't get along, and they surely played pretty well. But if the focus is forward, it doesn't hurt to have 5 or 6 guys that maybe played together in double and triple A and are at least don't hate each other. And I mean, and you see that the Cubs, they've done a pretty good job. That team is pretty much all for one. And I think the Sox are, too. Enough of the guys sort of came up and played triple-A ball together and so forth. And I think they're moving forward pretty good. And I'm surprised as this manager. I mean, everybody talks about the Sox and Cubs rivalry and, you know, they had the big fight the other night. But I never seen any, or I mean, I have, but they talk about someday it was Pat Hughes and who's the color guy, the third baseman, that was his name, the radio guy. I think he's really good.
Ron Coomer.
Yeah, Ron Coomer. And he's from the south side of Chicago. And Coomer goes, it doesn't surprise me a bit. He goes, is Will Venable, he's a terrific guy. He goes, when he was on the Cubs, he was the first base coach for the Cubs or something, minor league manager. He goes, he's a terrific guy. He's always gotten people to work together, to do stuff. This is not a surprise. He goes, that's how good the guy is. And you don't normally, in a competitive situation, have somebody like from the other team saying, but evidently he's very well respected. And he goes, he's doing the same thing he's done everywhere else. Everybody plays hard, everybody gets along, and they push. And he goes, he's done that every place, at every level he's been, minor league or whatever. So there is something to leadership, I think. I mean, so do you, I believe.
It's more than something. It is the most critical success factor, period. And that's in any organization, any kind of team setting. And you're right, you don't people don't have to love each other. It is a problem when people don't like each other, when there's genuine dislike. That is something that is very, very difficult to manage. But it really, I've had to do a lot of coaching people on this and over the years, and it really is all about, you know, what's the end game, and everybody knows and buys into what the end game is. And then when you have these kinds of conflicts, then you have to steer them back to what the vision is. And as long as people are operating in support of that, then, you know, a lot of the conflict can dry up or can be, you know, can be managed. But it really does help a lot when people really enjoy working together, whether it's working in a traditional office setting, working in a factory, or working on a baseball team. It doesn't matter. If people really enjoy working together, they don't have to love each other when they leave for the day, but there's a lot to be said for just having a lot of respect for what each other do and being willing to play off of each other. And that I think is the most critical factor, and it's the most underrated. Just look at, you know, I'll take Phil Jackson's coaching career as an example. You know, that was his gift with the Bulls. He wasn't the tactician. That was all laid off for, you know, Johnny Bach and Ted, you know, Tex Winter and guys like that. They handled the tactical stuff. Phil Jackson's gift was being able to keep everybody else focused, at least when they walked on the court, because the Bulls could be a real mess off the court, and their personalities weren't necessarily very good off the court. But if he could keep Scottie Pippen focused, if he could keep Jordan was, you know, like his guy, but, you know, and then somehow find a way to bring Rodman into the mix, and everybody's okay with Rodman being part of the mix as long as we're on the floor, and they all think he's nuts when he leaves the floor, that was it. But then when he went to Los Angeles and they won championships, and then he decided to retire once, and he was gone for 2 or 3 years, and the Lakers fell off, and they brought him back, and then the Lakers were a championship team again. And that wasn't a coincidence.
Nope.
They had Kobe Bryant, they had Shaq for part of that time, they had other guys. They had personalities that were hard to make mesh, and he was really good at getting through that. And that was, you know, that was his gift as a coach. It wasn't that he was the brilliant tactician.
Well, you also need nobody gives Jerry Krause any kind of too much credit, which I think is kind of false. But when you talk about the people with, you know, the nut jobs like Rodman, look at the people that they surrounded him with. I mean, it was all very stable. It was Will Perdue, it was Steve Kerr, it was Luke Longley.
Bill Cartwright.
Yeah, there were people that, you know,
Jackson, you know, guys like that. And Rodman was after Paxson, but even in the early years, it was guys like Paxson and Bill Cartwright and so on. That, yeah, they were stable. They were never the problem.
But if you would have put 3 21-year-old rookies on the team with Rodman, and all of a sudden they're going out to the bars with him, you would have had a problem. You didn't have to worry about that with Kerr or Longley or anything else. Right, I mean, so it's a question of...
Oh, yeah, well, and that was the case. Remember when they brought in Eddie Curry and Tyson Chandler out of high school?
Yeah, it was a
and
problem.
They had Ron Artest on the team, and Artest was a very good ball player, but he was also, you know, people always thought he was crazy, and they dealt him off for virtually nothing because they were afraid to have Curry and Chandler around him.
Well, who was the guys on the team when Jordan first got there, and he said in some of his memoirs, he goes, he was on the road, he walked into the suite in New York who the hell was before them? He was a good ball player. What the hell is his name? All of a sudden, all these guys got all this coke and everything.
Well, the guys that were there were guys like Reggie Theus. They might have had Orlando Woolridge. And a lot of those guys were big time partiers.
And, you know, and I still think to this day, and even though he's passed, right? Orlando, the big O?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, when those don't remember this, there was a time before they let people do the zone defense and stuff where you could essentially move 3 people to one side and play 2-on-2. What was the name of that they called it? It wasn't 2-on-2, but it was you know, if you're the center and you moved off to the
game,
the two man game, whatever they call it. When Jordan and Woolridge were the two guys, I don't know of any two people in the history of basketball that were better at that than those two guys. I mean, it might have been somebody, but
Malone and Stockton were decent at it.
But I'm saying, were they just actually Malone and Stockton played in the five man game, and they were, you know, they were, you know, the pick and roll they were terrific at. But I'm talking when you actually could move the other six people over to the side, and it was just four people playing. Could anybody have beaten those two guys in 2-on-2? I mean, the Big O was almost as fast as Jordan.
Would have been a
challenge. What was he? There was a guy, didn't he grow up? Wasn't he recruited to Notre Dame as a guard, and he grew like 4 inches that summer or something, or 3 inches?
Woolridge, yeah. He exploded as going from high school to college.
But he never lost that ability to handle the ball like a guard. Hey, what did you? You got a couple minutes before you got to run. What did you think of?
And we do have John on, so we'll hand him the baton. So keep going.
What did you think of Hal's rendition of being at sea on a ship that was kind of screwed up yesterday? Boy, it doesn't change, does it?
No, and I only heard the beginning of that before I had to head inside. So I can't really comment much about it. But yeah, it's a real challenge. I can't imagine. You know, if we wanted to turn that around and talk about being on the ship, imagine being in combat that long. You know, which in other ground wars we've had people in combat that long.
Oh yeah, well, they've been for years.
Yeah, and so that's boots on the ground with shots being fired at them.
Yeah, I mean it's a. But he was talking about
and even people who were deployed to the Middle East who had jobs on base, like. You know, I had a guy who worked for me who was in the National Guard. He got deployed. He spent 10 months in the Middle East, pretty much behind a computer near Kabul. But they still would have the rockets, you know, firing at him and all that kind of stuff. It could be really stressful. So yeah, I hear what Hal's saying. I think that's in many ways. Once a conflict starts, that's what you can expect in the military.
Well, I think there's been a massive, and this is not, you know, because of the Lincoln, because I'm not on the damn thing, but it's not because of that. I have sensed, you know, Kevin, you know, when we get to our age, you get to sense stuff. The idea that our, in World War II, when you had guys like, you know, Marshall, I don't know how many guys were like Marshall, but it was all about logistics. All about logistics, because wherever we go, just like you said, who knows how long we're going to be there. We better make sure we have the supply train. I mean, in his book, he said, you know, he goes, people ask me how I learned all this stuff. He goes, I learned it because when the Spanish-American War, he was a young guy. He goes, the troops took off in these boats for Cuba, and an hour later, all the vegetables that were supposed to go with them show up in Miami. They didn't even make the trip with the people. He goes, yet the thing lasted, you know, 3-4 days, and they got away with it. And I think the last, I mean, obviously Afghanistan is not that way, but it also wasn't naval, and it really wasn't all that much in the air every day. But, we were used to these, we went in 2 weeks kind of wars, and I've been kind of wondering.
Tom, I have to cut you off because I have to go.
All right, we'll go to John, and then whenever Eric shows up, we'll...
Good morning, John. Goodbye, John. And
take care, Kevin.
I'll be in touch.
When Eric shows up, Andrew, pile him in. John, what'd you think of this? Did you have a chance to see that thing I sent yesterday regarding the 1929 stuff? And today was pretty scary, I thought.
Yeah, I've seen those videos. I think they're AI produced, but that doesn't mean they're not interesting.
Well, there's a guy. I mean, the guy's not real. I was thinking of asking him.
I don't think he's real.
Really?
I mean, he looks like a real person, but the way that videos are produced and the camera work and stuff, I don't think it's his image that's, you know, live. It's being, you know, generated. And the lip syncing is not correct, but that doesn't mean I haven't watched his videos because the content is intriguing.
Just so everybody knows, we're really big into AI at Stacks and Jacks. This isn't really John Flanagan. This is just somebody.
I've been outed.
This is just a voice. We took pieces of his voice and all whatever we want him to say, he says.
Sometimes more convincing than others.
Yeah. but the you know, I just, it never dawned on me that if you let stuff go too far, even if you propose or even try and inject the right solution, it could be the straw that breaks the camel's back. And I guess it makes sense. I just never thought of it. Did you?
No, those narrations are shaped around, like, you know, it starts out with a particular person who's looking at some ticker event, you know, and it focuses, you know, the largest possible issues on a single moment, and then it sort of goes back out from that into the, you know, the larger sphere. So they're dramatically produced, and they tell a story very effectively. It, regardless of what the content is, I mean, but, and that content was good too. But those are engaging ways of.
Well, the summary I think makes sense. I mean, the summary was the Fed was aware of the issues early in 1926 as the speculative bubble kept moving, and by the time 29 came, when they actually tried to do something, just the doing of something caused the thing to fall apart because it was so far over the line. It couldn't take any kind of shock. You know, it couldn't take, you know, oh, we're not going to have 90% margin, we're going to go to 85 or something, which most people would say, well, that's not much of a move. But the point is, if you let it go too far, even that's enough to cause a problem. And I never really thought of it that way. But I think it's probably right. I mean, now this month, I say the margin debt came down, so I'm not near as worried about it, but we were up $200 billion in 3 months. Now, last month it dropped like 90, so we're still up a bunch in 3 months, 4 months, but nowhere near. And I don't know what we'd have done if we'd have done another 200 this last month. Then what? I mean, then we'd really be out on our skis. But then there's ways to get around that here, again, with the futures margins and those kinds of things. And Andrew, when you get Eric, just pile him right in, if he's calling in or coming in on Zoom.
Yeah.
You're here. You're here.
I'm here.
Hey, welcome, bud.
How are you?
Good. We have two English professors on the line. when have you ever seen that? John, where were you? You were at, tell them where you were. I don't have to tell them where
I
you
was
were.
At Prairie State College, and the 2-year college in Chicago Heights.
And Eric, you were at Columbia.
Yep.
And you have now retired.
I am retired.
But not expired worthless. You're still with us.
Yeah. I'm trying to be.
Well, there you go. What are you? What you're still writing?
Oh yeah.
How many books are you up to?
I'm two. One is a collection of short stories, and I'm plowing away. I'm at the end of a novel, getting the novel finished.
So that would be your second novel?
Yeah.
Oh, cool. So,
taught creative writing too, Eric?
Pardon?
Did you teach creative writing?
Yeah, that's what I taught.
And John, you were what? You were more of a writing.
I taught comp and, you know, literature surveys.
Mm-hmm. What's a literature survey?
Well, like, you know, British literature, you know, pre 1800, British literature post 1800, American literature 1865 and after, or American literature before 1865, African American literature. There are 200 level classes that are for people who are not necessarily English majors, but it gives you, you know, you read shorter selections, you get a wider, introduction to different, you know, styles, genres, and so on. So it's always very interesting to teach.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. If you were doing it now, you'd maybe have some of Eric's stuff you'd be reviewing.
As up to date as possible.
Eric, we've come across a whole bunch of stuff, and I'll ask both of you, but John's been on, but I'll get your views first. A lot of what's going on in the economy, you know, and in the world and so forth, and mm-hmm. you're starting to see some things with younger people. I mean, this last weekend, actually, a couple of guys, people you know, John Lee and his son is my godson. You've met him. But he, you know, I went to dinner with those guys Friday night because they were all in town, and because my godson's now out in San Francisco. Just a terrific kid, not because he's my godson, maybe in spite of that, but the fact, and he's, you know, John's got a niece, is pretty active in the progressive group here in Chicago. You know, she's been does a lot of work for the administration. She's kind of a consultant, but you know, I never could quite pin down what exactly she does. But some sort of a marketing consultant, very bright girl. And it's pretty interesting that they Eric, when you used to come on, we used to talk. Matter of fact, you were constantly quoted. You don't know that or not, because of the term you came up with, the management class. Yeah. And we've never been able, and I went there to explain to everybody that this morning, what you mean by that. Because we talk about the profit motive, but a lot of what we see is really in the nonprofit. There is no profit. And you talk about, you know, the profit motive, but yet you don't see people paying a whole hell of a lot of dividends. I mean, nobody cares about stockholders anymore. I mean, they think if the stock goes up, everybody should just be happy. And to a certain extent, they're right. But and she says, you know, we have to tax the rich. And I said, well, you know, careful with that. Some people actually might have earned. And then the next day, I go to my brother's and my nephew's there. He's a bright kid. And he's saying, look, he goes, you're right. There's some people that might actually have earned the dough. But the rest of them, through some combination of monopoly stuff from the government, you know, board members not doing their job, you know, shareholders never getting a dime. It seems like that 90% of these guys have essentially stolen the dough, or stolen's maybe too tough a word. I don't give a shit. Just tax the hell out of them. I mean, it shouldn't be their dough. And from being on a trading floor kind of guy, I'd just be appalled where if you had a good day, someday somebody would think that you somehow stole it or something. But this is what I think some of these younger people, you know, and they're not that far off, I don't think, Eric, in a lot of cases. What do you think all that?
Well, you know, back in the 1950s, you know, the wealthy were taxed at 91%.
Yeah, then it went to 70, and then, yeah.
And then it went, Kennedy Johnson, it went down to 70, and then Reagan, it went down to 50, and then 28, but then, of course, he was signing a lot of kind of under-the-radar tax increases, so that wasn't as perhaps as radical as it.
Well, you also had massive amounts of deductions then that you don't have now. Yeah.
Yeah, but one thing is this idea of a higher tax rate on the wealthy is not some sort of thing that's never happened in the country before, and we've never ever done this. You know, we have done it. You know, I think some of this is just an attempt to try to balance what is perceived to be a kind of where things have swung too far in one direction, and in terms of those who are making a whole lot of money. You know, I think one of the problems that happens is when you lump in anybody who makes a profit from anything other than a wage, and then you throw them in, someone who owns a two flat, and they're thrown in with the thing in the same group with a corporation that may be buying hundreds and thousands of apartment buildings and driving up rents and pushing out long-time tenants. I mean, you got to be careful not painting this kind of broad brush that anybody who makes any sort of money from anything other than their wages from a job is somehow part of the ruling class, because that's just, that's a simplistic way to look at it.
Well, I mean, my nephew, the argument was going, I said, well, Tim, you can't, if you run the rate up, because you're right, when I started, I think my very early career was kind of 70%, but then it was 50 right away. So you really can't, if the three of us, you imagine the business we would start, the three of us? If the three of us start a business, and guess what? We're right. We borrow the money, we go out, we build a place, let's say it's a hot dog stand, whatever. Speaking of which, did you see that today the Waffle House is going to start serving tacos?
Really?
Yeah. Wow, that's a reach. Anyway, but if you can't put your, if you expect people to do stuff, and guys like us to be the generator of new business, You can't say that if you're successful, we want 70% of it. And oh, by the way, if you're not successful, you only get to take off $3,000 a year for the rest of your life. I mean, it's just, even if we think we have the world's best idea, that's just a tough game. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, heads, you know, heads you win, tails I lose, kind of thing. I mean, you can't do that. I mean, I think somewhere in the 30s is probably fair to where, okay, you know, if I lose, that's okay, but if I win, at least I get to keep 65% of it. I mean, there's some number there which you and I are going to say, or the three of us are going to say, why are we doing this? Right? I mean,
yeah. Well, some folks are going to say that, yeah.
I mean, some people got enough of an ego that they don't care if it's 90%, they're going to win, right? Mm-hmm. But I mean, most rational people would say, wait a minute, if I do win, you get all the dough, and if I lose, I eat all the dough. It's kind of a tough deal, right? I mean, I think that, you know, again, I'm lobbing this out for you guys, but I think in California, I went through this, and I could be off, but I went through that if a pro golfer wins between the high-end millionaires tax and if they win a huge tournament on the 31st of December, I think they're paying like 63%. I think that's too much. I mean, I just, nobody, no government should be able to grab 63% of somebody's stuff, I don't think. But then again, that's just me. What do you think about it? I mean, there is a limit here, I think.
Well, I think what you have to do is there is a strong right now in the country pushback against what is perceived to be immense power being held by a few people, by a few corporations, who feel that they're in some way kind of steamrolling over everybody. You know, there's this big pushback now that's coming against you know, data centers. You know, Shapiro in Pennsylvania, the governor there just signed an executive order saying that no data centers can be built in the state unless the local people agree to it, and basically putting a stop on any data centers that are being built in the state. And in the governor's race up there in Wisconsin, you know, there's a huge back and forth between the Republican and Democratic candidates as to which one is too friendly toward data centers, you know, although both have in the past supported them in one way or another. And, you know, when people don't feel like they have, and this is going back to what you were talking about, you know, at your dinner, you know, when people feel like they don't have control over the majority of their life, they get really, really laser focused on what they think they can control. And in data centers is one of the things. And this idea that we have to somehow get control over the Elon Musk of the world, you know.
I might be in that group.
Yeah, I mean, there's this feeling that we are just getting, that the average person is getting steamrolled by corporations that, you know, basically have a lot of political influence. And this cuts across everything from, you know, Facebook to, you know, Ford to, you know, you name it. And this idea that somehow, you know, and this feeling that neither of the major political parties are going to do much because they're getting so much money from, you know, corporate donations that none of the, neither major political party is going to push back much against it. That's the perception.
Well, I think it's more than the perception.
Yeah, I mean that's the perception. No, I mean, well, you could also say, you know, that's the perception, that's the belief. But if we always remember, you know, that people believe what they fear.
Well, they also, and, I mean, John, pile in when you want. But I mean, my God, these guys are buying the newspapers, for God's sake. I mean, it's turned into a total plutocracy.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's not there yet, but
Eric, how do you think of college or the selling of college as an option for young people has, you know, fed into this, you know, condition where people.
Oh yeah, this idea. You know, again, this, you know, for a long time the perception was you go to college, you get a degree, and you will, and this is going to elevate your earnings, and that's still true. I mean, you know, a college education is a huge leg up in terms of getting jobs. I mean, one of the most important things you learn from being in college is that you learn how to learn, because so many professions, you know, you can't just stick with what you knew or what you know when you graduated from college. Or when you started in a particular industry. I mean, Tom, think about how much have you had to learn, Tom, over the last 40 years?
I'm at about my fifth change.
Yeah, exactly. And so, and one of the things you learn from college is that you learn how to do that. You learn how to learn more stuff. And if you don't learn how to do that, then you can kind of get stuck. But what's happened is that college, once we decided we were not going to fund college education with easy to get Pell grants. I remember back when I first entered college in 1971, you could get a Pell grant in about 4 or 5 days. You could apply for a Pell grant on a Monday, and maybe by Friday or the next Monday, the Pell grant had come through. And then the Reagan administration came along and said, we are no longer going to do a lot of this underwriting of college education. And then that's when you started hearing people, college students and their parents talking about, you know, this whole thing of debt, being in debt, after, you know, graduating from college and being $100,000 in debt. When I graduated,
Eric, where did you go?
Went to Columbia College.
Okay, so could you remember?
Here's what I remember. I remember what we weren't talking about. Nobody, none of my cohorts, when I graduated in 1975, we're talking about debt because we didn't have any.
Little. Do you remember what the tuition was? I know at Notre Dame.
The tuition was about, I know when I started in 1971, the tuition was $715 a semester.
So $1,500 a year. Notre Dame was $3,000, and I was a year earlier than you.
Yeah, and so, but it's, you know, it went up a little bit.
Well, even if you borrowed it all.
Let me just say that the college education that Columbia College students were getting in the second half of my teaching career was a lot better than the one I got. Simply because it was a bigger school, it had deeper pockets, was able to offer a lot more to students than what I got. I got a good education, and I think that's true of a lot of colleges. I think that the college education the students are getting is a higher quality education, but it's costing so much money, and there's not necessarily the jobs out there that you can step into, and where you're going to be able to earn a living, move out of your parents' house, and be able to pay off your loans and have a life. And you can't take that out of the mix as to why people are upset, because, you know, the class of people who are getting upset now are the educated class. And, you know, when the poor feel economically deprived, there are riots. When the educated feel economically deprived, there are revolutions. And so I think what we're seeing now is some of that, is that the educated class now feels they're in the same kind of, many of them feel they're in the same kind of economic bind that the working class and others have felt for a while now.
Well, 2 points real quick, and I'll ask Jan to comment. Now, one of the issues, and I don't know how big of it is, but I want, you guys aren't into the numbers as much as I am, which probably makes you better, you know, happier in life. I just put your 1,500 hours a year in the inflation calculator from June 1975. Mm-hmm. And according to our various and sundry governments, they're going to say that today would be $9,300. And I'm going to say It's nowhere near the tuition of Columbia College.
No, it isn't. And I'll tell you something else. My first apartment I got when I graduated from college in the fall of 1975, it was a one-bedroom apartment with a dedicated dining room even, and East Rogers Park, half block from the lake, just off of Sheridan Road on Estes. And that one-bedroom apartment cost me $170 for rent. I went back, and sometimes I'll go back and look at my old building and see what the apartments are going for. And that apartment now is going for probably about $1,300 a month, which is, some might argue, that's not necessarily a huge, huge spike in terms of in terms of monies. But when I realized that I was making $90 a week,
how much did
I
you was, say you were making? It was 150 a month.
It was 170 a month.
All right. Well, I got the calculator up here.
$90 a week. I had a job in the
that should be $1,059 according to our CPI.
Yeah, I had a job in the as a stockroom clerk at the Chicago Tribune. That was the job that got me out of my parents' house. And but you know what's happening is you know, a lot of the jobs that me and my cohorts had when we just got out of college, the job that got us out of our parents' houses don't exist anymore. That clerk job is done. Nobody keeps inventory in a stock room in an old ledger book like I used to work with. And a lot of the other jobs had entry-level jobs that weren't necessarily something you were going to do for a lifetime, but they were enough to get you out of your folks' house. And one of the things that has happened is a lot of those jobs are not there anymore. It's now you come out and you can't find anything that can necessarily get you out of your parents' house. And that's the thing, even more so than the debt, that can be really, truly frustrating. You know, you got your college degree, you're out of college, and you look up, and I can't, you know, I got to have three roommates to survive, you know, to have an apartment, or I can't get an apartment by myself. And I remember most of my cohorts, friends that I worked with at the Tribune, who had various other peonic jobs. We all, most of us, had our own apartments.
Did you ended up going to Washington to being a reporter, but did you ever think about the city desk here when you were here?
You went, what, the City News Bureau?
Yeah, then whatever it was they used to call it. With all the
yeah, I worked for the City News Bureau when I was in high school.
Really?
And I did that. I reported football statistics, high school football statistics. That was my first real paying newspaper job. And I had to keep the stats and then phone them in.
Did you work for Taylor Bell? Or was he?
Yeah, but the City News Bureau was a training. I mean, nobody ever went to the City News Bureau thinking that that was going to be their job.
Okay.
It was a training. It was a way of people went there to get their reporter sea legs, and it was a good way to do it. It was basically an Associated Press or a UPI for the city for the Chicago metropolitan area. It's essentially what it was. And it allowed newspapers to not necessarily have to try to cover everything.
What's kind of interesting, what you were mentioning. And John, please pile in on this. For how many years, John, have we been doing the show? It's great to have Eric back. Where we've talked about, you know, the huge criticism of going to college, and you know, some guy, don't take this wrong, guy, you know, somebody taking English, what the hell are they going to do? And you know, and Eric has just talked about how you're supposed to go there and learn how to learn, and yet I think you might have met him one night over at Ceres way back, Eric. Dr. Mark Johnson, he was in town for a football game. Anyway, I think he might have, but he was talking about how he's been doing this. He's a retired, well, he's not really retired, but he's still doing stuff. He's doing all this consulting work in New York City about all these people that are getting laid off and they're in the IT industry.
Yeah.
Now, those are people that, and Jen, tell me if I'm wrong, where people go, if you're going to go to college, become an engineer, become an IT guy. Get yourself a friggin' job when you get out there. Don't learn English. Don't learn economics like a knucklehead like me. find something that's saleable. It's like a vocational school, which is totally different than what you just said. Now Mark is talking about these guys are in their 30s and 40s, and they're losing their IT jobs. That's all they have. They have no idea. They never took an accounting class. They never took a finance class. They were told that if you have an IT education, you know, just like, you know, way back in the day, if you were a welder or something, if you're a welder, you never have to worry about a job. He says, now all of a sudden, these guys, there's nothing there. Plus, what do you say, Mark or John, about the if you lose your job and, you know, I guess you're living with your parents, Eric, like you and I did for a while. You know what? You lose your job, kind of, so what? But he says, if you lose your job in New York and your rent's $10,000 a month, even if you saved up a bunch of money, you've got like a 3-month window to find something pretty damn fast.
Yeah.
You know, but it's almost like there's a backlash now to knowing only one thing. You know, is that, Jan, what do you say about it? Do you think that
I've been retired now since 2013, but even before I retired, you know, where I taught, they were cutting back on IT course offerings because I think the word had come out that the job market for people with IT backgrounds is drying up. It used to be that, you know, you say, well, you got to know how to do word processing. You got to be able to master Word and Excel, at least do that, and maybe even programming beyond that, and, you know, how to, you know, manage a web network and whatever if you have to work at some place, or maybe in an entry-level job. But the message had gone out, and I think the counselors must have been aware of this, because from what I heard from students, they were downplaying the possibility of getting a job at IT, even around 2010 or 2011, and that you better have some other arrows in your quiver, because that wasn't going to be a sure bet anymore. And I remember I was really stunned to hear that, because I thought that, above all, would be something that you could always parlay into a job somewhere, some entry-level position, with some kind of just understanding of things that I didn't understand when I came out of college, and I had to kind of learn them by the seat of my pants. But if you knew that coming out of college, you'd be always, I thought, pretty well set up to get some kind of a paycheck. And boy, that wasn't the case at all. But, you know, what else could you tell a student to do today to kind of bolster your chances of getting an entry-level job? What are the entry-level jobs now? They're not really white-collar jobs at all. They're, you know, they're working at a fast food place, if you're lucky enough to get that job. So,
and
go ahead, Eric. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, and the thing is, you know, of course, AI is throwing a huge curveball into all of this, because nobody quite knows how things are going to shake out in terms of what AI is going to actually do in terms of jobs. You know, is AI going to produce a whole new round of wealth and profit and boost the economy, or is AI going to wind up, you know, throwing vast amounts of people out of work with no other way for them to use it? Now, you'll hear some people say, you know, that what you have to do nowadays is you have to learn how to use AI to do whatever it is your career is, or whatever your field is. You got to figure out how to use it. That AI is a tool, it's not a ruler, but right now nobody knows. And so you have a lot of businesses saying, well, we're not going to go out and hire a bunch of people if I can get AI to come in. And, you know, this whole big thing that's been going on lately with this AI company that basically reads resumes, you know, and that people are turning in their because what's happening is with computers, it used to be if you wanted to send your resume out, you had to mail them, put them in snail mail, as they call it, and, you know, a person is only going to send out so many of those things. Nowadays, you can send a resume out to, what, 100 places? And so businesses are going, well, how do we read all of this stuff? Well, we'll just hire an AI company that'll read it, and it'll have. And the AI company says, look, we can read the resumes, and we can, you know, we can cull the herd down to the absolute people you actually want to talk to. And so it's becoming this thing where nobody knows how, like I said, how this is going to shake out. And that's causing all kinds of uncertainty. You know, businesses are saying, well, maybe we don't need to hire a whole lot of people now to do a lot of stuff anymore because AI is going to take care of it. And so that uncertainty is just piling up on top of everything else.
Well, one of the flies in this ointment, and I actually want to get a comment from just so happens our engineer today kind of is involved in what you just mentioned, Eric. But, you know, the thing that's the fly in the economic ointment and all this stuff, when you say the newspapers don't hire guys like you anymore, they don't need that. They got all this stuff. It's on computers. It's just, if you take that forward and you use, you know, economic theory, you would say, okay, over time, all they're saving should mean that the rest of the paper is, quote, better and cheaper. Yet, that's not the way it went. I mean, it's not like the newspaper back then was, what, 7 cents, 10 cents? And now, now it's, what is it, every day, a buck and a half, some ridiculous number?
Way more than a half.
Okay. What's a Sunday paper? Four or something?
Four or five.
So, I mean, that doesn't compute. If you get rid of all these people and you do it much more efficiently, I'm not saying it should be 5 cents today because of all the inflation we've had, but somehow or another, the theory isn't there.
Again, my job was in the stockroom, and the reason I mention it is, it was the kind of bridge job that a lot of businesses had. You know, people forget that every business was keeping its records by hand almost. Yeah. And you needed a lot of people to do that. Now, these jobs didn't pay a lot of money, but they paid enough. Like I say, it could be a bridge job that you got right out of college. And while you were figuring out, if you hadn't figured it out already, well, what am I going to, you know, exactly what am I going to do with my life? But in terms of newspapers, what's happened with them is that people still want to read the news. They're just not necessarily interested in reading it in a newspaper. And so what's happened is that the newspapers made all of their money off of the classified ads. Well, where are all the classified ads now? Remember back in the days on a Sunday with the Tribune or something, and there would be a real estate section, and it would be pages after pages after pages after pages of these little rectangular ads for a house, you know, and maybe with a little bad photograph of the house, and then a few lines about what the house had. Well, nobody's going to advertise a house sale like that. Now you're going to go to Redfin or Zillow or Trulia or Realtor or Homes.com or something like that. Well, that was millions of dollars that newspapers were getting. Remember in the old days, there were the want ads?
Oh, yeah.
Remember
the
want
ads? Those, sales. You know, whatever.
Those were all classified ads. Yeah. And they were paying, that's what was paying the freight. And all of that advertising is gone. And now the news websites, which are still very popular, the news websites, not that they're not popular, but most of that ad revenue is going to Google. It's not going to the newspaper. Right. And so it's almost like as if an old newspaper was paying most of their profit money to the people who provided them with the paper and the ink. And so so they don't have nearly the kind of, and that's actually what's happened with them. They just don't have the kind of throw weight. And people have a lot shorter attention spans, and they don't necessarily want to read a story that's going to go, you know, on for two or three pages like they used to in a lot of big papers on Sunday. And a lot of folks, it's that, and the fact that in the modern world, you know, when do you have time to read a newspaper?
You need to make time at some point to read the whole article. But we got to go to break quick, and we come back.
Yeah, sure.
Andrew actually, we won't say who he works for or what he's doing, but he does some marketing work, essentially to fool AI, and he uses AI to fool AI. So S&P futures up a buck, NASDAQ futures down 34.
Yeah.
We'll be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
What are you going to do with your old car? You can try selling it, you could junk it, or you can donate it to Heritage for the Blind. Your car will be towed away for free, and your donation is tax deductible. Just call 1-800-639-8620. Heritage for the Blind accepts cars, vans, trucks, and boats. It doesn't matter if your vehicle runs or not, it'll be towed away for free. and you'll be supporting those that need help. Heritage for the Blind is a nonprofit organization that helps the visually impaired live fuller lives. Call right now to donate your car. And as a special thank you for calling, you'll receive a free 3-day vacation voucher to many exciting locations. Call Heritage for the Blind right now. Call 1-800-639-8620. Donating is easy, and your vehicle is towed away for free. Plus, you'll get a free vacation voucher. Call now, 1-800-639-8620. That's 1-800-639-8620.
Stocks, jocks,
stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Allen, on the board. We have Dr. Eric May. We have Mr. Jan Flanning. We have two professors here today, which is terrific. That's if you're.
Well, I'm not a doctor. I never got a doctor.
Oh, you never got a doctor?
Well,
you
could. Neither.
Well, you could be like, you could just put doctor in front of your name, like Dr. J, and everybody think you are.
Well, you know,
you could do that. That's like you say. SP futures up 7. NASDAQ futures up 12. We were down pretty much last night, but we're not today. We're down heavy yesterday. Over in Asia, we've got the. Got the Nikkei down 2,100 points. That's a big number. 3%, 65,326. And again, this is, we'll talk a bit about this when we're done with the traffic, weather, and sports, because this is a problem, what's going on with the Nikkei, because we have to be a little more concerned about what's going on worldwide with our allies than I think we sort of are. Who knows what's really going on? But Hang Seng up 23, which is, well, it's pretty much flat, but still, it's not down. Shanghai, however, we're down 95. That's 2.4%. So somehow Hang Seng is missing this sell-off, but the mainland China and the Nikkei are both down real heavy. We're in Europe. We got the DAX down 41.1%. FTSE down 8. Call that flat. Heck, around up 27.3. So Europe is pretty much unchanged. Yesterday, as a way of review, S&P was down 53. That was 0.7%. NASDAQ was down 355, 1.3%. The chip makers were just getting hammered yesterday. Other tech stocks were up, which is even crazier. We have the U.S. 10-year down 5 basis points today at 4.65. It's the first down move there in a while. I've got the 30-year is down to under top 5.3. Now it's down to 5.23. So we're getting a little bit of relief there. I mean, it's probably why the market has come back here a little bit. Oil is up 32 cents, 85.26. Again, this is, I'm going to try to tie this together with the Japanese issue. Gold is up 440 today. It was down yesterday, but now it's up a little bit today. Foreign exchange, in the Japanese yen, it's back down to 158.78. Again, careful with this one, because this means 159 yen to the dollar. Now, when you say the euro is 116, that's a dollar's worth, a euro is worth $1.16. So when it gets higher, they flip the thing the other way. So careful when you're looking at it. Same thing with the British pound. British pound is worth $1.35. Okay, that's easy to figure. Crypto, down 73 bucks, 64,586, been remarkably steady lately. Not sure why they're steady. Everyone else is all over the place, but they are. Andrew, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
All right, it is 7:36 here in Chicago, Wednesday, August 19th. A little bit of sports here. The Cubs won over the Sox last night. And right at the end, the Cubs took it over, winning by a single point in just the ninth.
Like 11:30.
Yeah, went right till the end there, and it was a final score was 4-3. Diamondbacks did lose though to the Red Sox 4-9. Over Chicago, weather is currently 67 degrees, gonna have a high of 77 today. Gonna be pretty humid throughout the morning, and we're gonna have a mix of clouds and sun throughout the whole day. Over in Phoenix, they're currently at 92 degrees with a high of 110. Not too uncommon, at least from what I see here, where they got a dangerous heat warning. But what is a little bit rare is that they're going to have some thunderstorms rolling in throughout this afternoon and evening. And finally, for Chicago traffic, in the inbound Kennedy from Montrose, it's going to take you 25 minutes. Inbound Edens from Lake Cook is going to take you 40 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf Road is going to take you 32. Dan Ryan from 95th is going to take you 25 minutes. And the inbound Stevenson from I-294 is going to take you 32 minutes. That's all I got. Back to you, Chief.
Andrew, can you comment a little bit on how you use AI?
I mean, obviously, I've been listening to this whole, you know, conversation about the job market and everything, and I'm such a pessimist where it's like, I'm agreeing with anything, that's why I haven't added anything to it. As for the AI, so Well, my company is, it's actually transitioning right now. So it's mainly SEO marketing, which SEO marketing is essentially you're marketing, but it's all on the back end. So you're making Google, I should say from the start, SEO stands for Search Engine Optimization, which 9 times out of 10 just means Google. And you're making websites just appear on Google higher on the rankings. It's as simple as, like, if you Google, like, best home siding replacements in Chicago, like, we help siding companies and basically any kind of, you know, smaller business like that reach higher rankings on the on Google. But where it's transitioning is it's going from SEO to AIO. So now, instead of wanting to be on the top of Google, we want to be referenced by AI. And to do that, to do both of these things, SEO or AIO, a lot of the content is just AI generated.
So you use AI to fool AI?
Yeah, basically. And I mean, I'm a pretty anti-AI person, you know, because I come from an art background, and like, my whole thing is when I got into the position, there wasn't any mention of AI. It was like I did like a writing example and a, you know, like, oh, like write a blog, an example blog page kind of thing. And then I got into it and I was like, oh yeah, this is a lot more AI than I expected. I think one of you guys had mentioned earlier, like, you know, nowadays it's like you kind of have to know AI to do what you want to do rather than, you know, just being able to avoid it. But anyway, yeah, essentially it's like, you're making articles, blogs, small pieces of content, like, which that's what I'm like, that's why I'm like fine with it, you know, because it's not like you're putting some major article out, you know, that a ton of people are gonna see, and you know, it's something that was just generated.
So Eric, you're writing stuff for AI to read and not for me to read. What do you think?
Yeah. Well, eventually you're writing it for people to read, but what you're doing is that you're using AI to do a lot of the work. And if you're talking about writing, basically stuff that's form writing, and this is where newspapers come into to the picture. You know, a lot of the news stories are form stories. Yesterday it was really hot story. Yesterday it snowed a lot story. Then there's a yesterday this place burned down story. Then there's yesterday somebody got shot story. And if you look at them, I mean, basically as one editor at the Washington Post told me when I was first starting, he said, you know, what we do here is more of a craft than an art. And what we do here basically is lay bricks. And you develop a style into which information can fit, and then you can lay a lot of bricks really fast. And so, you know, it's not necessarily that you're writing, you're not like you're sitting there and creating a completely new story every time you have to write a news story. It's basically, there's a way to write a story about yesterday was there was a flood. And then it's just a matter, once you learn and internalize what that form is, then you can just go out, get the information, you know, where, when, who, what, and then you can come back to the newsroom and you can write that story pretty quickly. Well, what AI does now is it can take in other words, you can punch in, theoretically, okay, there was a fire yesterday on such and such street. But you just punch in the form, and then the reporter just calls in the details, and then bingo, you got your story. And with a minimal amount of copy editing, because it's not being created from scratch, most of the stuff in there, you just got to check the information you're putting into, and you're all set to go. So, you know, what AI is doing in terms of writing, it's suddenly creating this thing where we have something that's form writing, and you can just, you know, AI can just bang, do this right away. And this is what's happening with resumes, and this is what's happening with a lot of things. And that's really kind of where nobody knows where this is going to go exactly, in terms of, you know, how much writing is actually ever going to even be what you would call writing, which is somebody composed this from scratch and then produced it. And as AI keeps growing and growing and growing and growing, you know, I mean, there's this whole thing right now, I got to check this out, where, you know, AI basically took a lot of people's books that they were able to get a hold of online and then used it to sell AI to people, you know. So
Well, Kevin talks a lot, and, you know, Jan's heard this, if you put, like for instance, a lot of times if Kevin's given an exam, you know, and he wants to have a smaller boutique brokerage firm, like I have, PTI, I mean, my brother and I, and if he can say to AI, well, he has to punch in, I don't know how he does it, but you say to AI, well, give me a balance sheet and an income statement and those kinds of things for what would be a smaller boutique brokerage firm. Well, if my brother was dumb enough, which he's not, to put our stuff into AI to help him out, Kevin says they're going to just steal your place, and that'll be the thing that pops up on my test. He says, so you got to be real careful about putting stuff in there because it becomes theirs, which is sort of bizarre. You know that, well, Eric used to live down a block from me. You know, Tarantino's sold out to this Kimmy place or Dimmy, whatever the name is. John, this place from day one has been mobbed.
Yeah.
And I don't think, I mean, you literally can't get in the door. And they'll tell you if you go there, you got an hour and a half and you got to leave because somebody else coming in. I mean, and yet, Bill Murphy, our friend, when last weekend, he goes, food's nowhere near as good as Taren. They started yelping themselves, like, before the thing even opened.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very effective if you do it right. It's kind of scary, isn't it? But it's pretty
effective. And that whole thing about, you know, advertising on these testimonials, which you have to be very, very suspicious of. These testimonials.
Well, they're banned in our industry, so, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, it's you don't know who's you don't know if somebody gave a kid, you know, look, we're going to give you about 200 different email addresses, and we want you to write either a whole bunch of positive reviews or something, or a bunch of negative reviews. You know, and you know this is true sometimes because you'll read a whole bunch of the negative ones. They'll say a lot of the same thing. If I could give this place less than 4 stars, I would. You know, and so that's hard to, I don't, you know, that's hard to take because you don't know where that's coming from. But, you know, yeah, I heard about that. I heard you can't get into that joint. It has great computer word of mouth.
Oh yeah,
and but it's also, you know, they're selling very sort of traditional red gravy kind of food, and Tarantino was a lot more Northern Italian, kind of stuff, and this is what they're really, say for like Pasta Palazzo, which is over there on Halston and Armitage. There aren't a whole lot of Italian places around there. And so this was kind of filling a niche of, you know, folks who want to make sure every time they walk into an Italian restaurant, there's spaghetti and meatballs on the menu. Or there's lasagna on the menu.
Yeah, well.
Or chicken cacciatore on the menu. And, you know, Tarantino's was a lot more varied. Sometimes they had spaghetti and meatballs, but not all. It wasn't often. It was rare that they had them.
The food there was very good. I mean,
the food was amazing.
Yeah.
That's pork chop in town. But, you know, this is, it's almost like you know exactly what you're going to get when you go to a place like that. It's why McDonald's is making a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know exactly what you're going to get when you walk into a McDonald's. And that kind of Italian restaurant, you know exactly what you're going to get. They're not going to be... Tarantino's used to have stuff like black squid, linguine, you know, and a lot of people were looking at
these young kids. These young kids want no part of that. I mean... What the... We've kind of bounced around on the education and other stuff, but that's okay. Because, you know, I mean, you were on enough early on, Eric, to know that my theme is all these subjects all sort of come together. I mean, we can talk about you know, what goes on in a naval ship with Hal one day and talk about Carl. It's all kind of the same thing. It's people trying to have, it's all logistics. It's all doing the job right. It's all getting people to work together. What do you think the outcome, I mean, right now we have these issues, and I started the show today talking about, you know, where the Fed is with their, in the markets and over, maybe overpriced, maybe this, maybe that. What, right now we seem to have, and it's not just this administration, because you go back to, you know, George Bush doubled the deficit when he was in office. You know, Obama doubled the deficit. Trump was well on his way, even though he was in there for 4 years. And by the way, so was Biden. And we had both groups, you know, basically lied the piss out of us by, you know, Trump lowered taxes and said, oh, by the way, this is really going to be accretive. And then this is his first term. When everybody knew it wasn't going to be accretive. And then when Biden came out and said his infrastructure bill, oh, by the way, you know, Inglewood's going to have, you know, 5 stars on your phone, and that's going to cause everybody to have a great job. And 5 years from now, it's actually going to be accretive. Come on, we knew that wasn't going to be accretive either. So now we're doing the same thing, and we're trying to back this all up with, you know, with tariffs that really are a tax on us, but we're trying to tell people they aren't. Yeah. But the fact is, last month we had a $400 billion deficit. Now we've got this massive debt. We've got the problem in the Middle East, which is causing some of our allies, notably Japan. And I'm not sure, guys, that, I mean, I hope, first of all, when something, everybody's looking for the straw that breaks the camel's back, right? And you're always wrong. Yet when you see things going toward this direction, I wonder if the stuff that's happening in Japan in terms of their interest rates going up, and oh, by the way, their national debt is like double ours per person, and all of a sudden they've got to spend all this money on oil, and their currency's dropping, and our Treasury Department helped them out 2 weeks ago with this massive purchase of yen, which they used some euros to do, which pissed all the people off in Europe. I mean, you know, I don't want to go through all that because not many people understand it, really. I mean, I don't fully understand it, but I know some of it. Now, we're finding ways to essentially pump money to Japan so they show up at the next auction to buy our treasuries. Well, that's a zero-sum game, I think, in the end. So, but now what is, we've got this massive deficit. We've got a group in office that is convinced that they can't ever raise taxes because that's their group. Now, we're going to have a group that maybe comes in that's going to look and try and, you know, tax the rich, but how much can you tax 1% of the people to cover a $40 trillion deficit? I mean, the numbers just aren't there either. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, Bernie Sanders, once in a while, I don't mind what he says, but I really need, I don't want to send the guy, anthrax in an envelope. You know, I wouldn't do that to anybody, but I would sure like to send the guy a calculator someday. I mean, nothing adds up what he says. I mean, you know, it's somewhere along the line, there's going to be an end game to this, and I don't know what it is. Somehow or another, it's got to be some sort of taxation, or we got to stop spending on some stuff. We could do that in the medical community, because we talked earlier about, you know, Kenny's wife going to the hospital for 2 hours, it was an $11,000 bill. I mean, that can't keep happening. Yet I don't see either side of the aisle tackling that at all. What do you see, Eric? I haven't had you on in a while. Where is the solution here? Is there one?
Well, you know, you're getting, in some ways now with these tariffs, you're getting what you had under Herbert Hoover, you know, where, you know, the depression started, and he said, well, the way to solve that is we'll start slapping tariffs on everything. And that was disastrous. because then people started slapping tariffs on American goods, and that suddenly the whole world economy just got choked and stopped. And everybody, you know, the thing that's hitting us now is we have an administration that is just nutty. I mean, we have a president who thinks that either he professes to think that tariffs are a tax on the other guy and not a tax on us. And that's like someone saying that water isn't wet. You know, I don't know what to do with someone who is so completely detached from reality and has an economic policy that is just detached from reality. And it doesn't even matter if you're this kind of an economist or that kind of an economist. Every economist understands what a tariff is. And we have an administration that says, oh, no, that's not what it is. It's this thing over here because that's what the president wants it to be.
What do you make of...
And my concern is that what could happen is what happened in the 30s. We saw something similar in the 2000s when people started putting all of their money into investments and not putting... This is what was happening when Coolidge cut taxes in the 20s, is that people started putting their money in investments and none of that money was going into infrastructure or building anything solid. And it was a bubble. And then we got the Great Depression. And I'm worried that we're headed to something like that now with this combination of huge debt, completely crazed economic policy, and then these wars that are costing us a lot of money. And now you're getting countries like North Korea and Turkey, which are saying we're basically going to be rent-a-soldier, and we're going to start sending our troops to fight your wars over here. And it's what I worry about is that it's a perfect storm.
What do you make of
a number of things feeding into this, and it could be the straw that breaks the camel's back, or it could be the 16 tons that breaks the camel's back. But I worry that the camel's back is going to get broken.
What do you make of and Janet, what you comment on this, Carl? The tariffs. I mean, I'm not into. There was a time, I think, when we first started, where we protected our garment industry. We're talking in the 1800s,
yeah,
and allowed them essentially to build up, get them ahead of steam against the British. Okay, now you could argue that maybe they served a purpose back then. But what do you make of? I'm against just general kind of stuff because actually interesting aside. Eric, I don't think, maybe Jan was listening. Larissa was on a couple weeks ago, and I said, and she teaches third year at Purdue, right, some economics. Mm-hmm. And I said, if you were to put a tariff, because, by the way, this was on my final exam with Milton Friedman, so I know I know a little bit about it. And just to say, I mean, I think the exam was, we're putting a $5,000 tariff on Mercedes-Benz's, work that through stock and flow for the next 15 years. And we're talking about one item, one car. Mm-hmm. It was a serious, sitting there in your blue book, it was a blue book and a half. Mm-hmm. And how just it works all the way through, okay, they're doing this, now what does Mercedes do? Do they charge less now because they still want to be a little more competitive over here? Does the dealer here eat a little bit? So is the tariff really going to be $5,000 on the $50,000 car, or is it really $4,800 because everybody cut back? And then what happens to Cadillac? Do they gleefully say, well, now we can raise the price of the Cadillacs? And it works. It's a huge amount. There's probably 10 variables by the time you're done. That's one item. Okay.
Yeah.
So I said to Larissa, if you put this on the wall with your class, could anybody work through that? She goes, not only could nobody work through it, within a second there'd be a huge fight based on your political beliefs, with nobody being able to work through it all. But on the tariff part, the thing that Carl brings up, and I never thought of it, and that's why I love doing the show, and John's heard him say this a million times, what if, we off stuff to China, which we have, and all of a sudden we don't let 14-year-olds work here, but they do. Or we don't want pollution here, but they don't care. We have you and John have a business on this side of the Rio Grande, and we say, well, you can't pollute the Rio Grande. Okay, we're going to move it to the other side and pour the same crap into the river from the Mexican side. He thinks that there needs to be a different sort of tariff to sort of even that up so our people here don't get crushed. Now, I'm not so sure that I'm so against that. I don't know how you do it properly, but... the idea that, okay, we can't have 12-year-olds working here, well, these guys don't care, we'll send the stuff over there. I don't know that we should be doing that necessarily, and I don't know how to stop it, but that's one way to at least think of it, but I don't know if that's the solution either.
I can see parallels between the 30s and now, but there's also so many other anomalies that would have been unthinkable in the 30s that I do think that this is only going to change when there's some kind of international shakeout, you know, a cataclysm like the Depression that was pretty much worldwide with a few outliers that didn't suffer maybe quite so much. But, you know, we didn't have a situation in the 30s like we have now with, the, you know, the world's second biggest economy, a totalitarian state, in which we are, you know, a mortal enemy. And they want to, you know, have the slow process of destroying us. And we're shaking hands with them and building plants there with their, you know, all this crazy stuff that would have been mind-boggling to anybody in the 30s. And we've just allowed all this stuff to get offshored, and we don't care, you know, and the Chinese certainly don't care. And then you have declining birth rates, which, you know, this is an unsustainable kind of revenue source. We're spending ever more money at relying on the backs of fewer and fewer people to pay the bills. This is happening not just in the U.S. I mean, the U.S. is kind of holding its own population-wise, but just barely. And other states are in the tank. So this is all going to shake out, I think, in some horrible domino set where something happens in China or some bank in Europe, and everybody is going to be like clueless about how to stop what's going to follow. And it'll be just as challenging, if not a lot more challenging, than it was in the 30s to dig our way out. And I don't know how long it will take and what it's going to look like at the end of it, but we don't really have a playbook for what's happening now. You know, stuff we should have learned, we can't use anymore because the facts are so different, and nobody seems to be in a hurry to change their thinking about anything. So,
we're not big on new thinking. So Eric, I hope you're going to be somewhat of a regular. We love having you, bud. Name me another show that had two English professors on the same day.
talking about economic stuff, you know, that's a big rarity.
Well, you know, it economics is a social science, right? It's just like sociology. Right. I mean, when somebody said, "What about you, economists?" I said, "Hey, economists is very simple. Well, economists is the apportionment of scarcity." They go, "What are you talking about?" So how you don't have? It's not like you got a replicator on the Enterprise or anybody. Everybody can have a steak tonight, right? So if everybody can't have one, how do you apportion who gets one? Next time you're on, Eric, I want to talk a little bit, and John was in on this too. I mean, you two guys together, by the way, are great guests. This whole idea that if you don't like what's currently happening, you're immediately branded a socialist, even though the person who calls himself a socialist probably doesn't even know what socialism is, which is...
Don't even get me started on the use of working people. You know.
Wait a minute. We're going to get you started next week.
Oh, okay.
S&P futures up 32, and NASDAQ futures up 139. We got a rally coming here. Gold's going up pretty good here. We're going to make back some of the stuff we lost yesterday, maybe all of it. Thank you, guys. Good job, Andrew. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks.
Stay here. Take care, fellas.
Yep.
That's all, folks.